Wednesday, the 3rd of April, 2024, and it is 25 to 6. Time to head to work. Listening to a great podcast there at the moment. It's called Empire, and it's all about the role of empire in civilization. Essentially, it starts off with the Indian or the British Empire in India, and some of the episodes, the first number of episodes, for example, the East India Company. The East India Company was a limited company that ruled India for 150 years. So you have this continent of India with massive resources, and yet it was being run by a limited company. It's as if Facebook or Google were actually running, say, the European Union. Some people might say that they are, but obviously that's hyperbole. East India Company ran and governed and organized affairs and administered rule, as it were, in India for 150 years. Eventually then, Indians, there was a number of massacres and there was unrest and so on, and there was the First World War, and eventually the Brits had to take over. So the Brits actually nationalised the East India Company and then ruled Britain, or ruled India directly from London, with their own administration and their own state, as it were, their own administration in India. So you have company rule in India, you have mutiny, uprising and rebellion, you have between two massacres, you have the Jallianwala Bagh massacre, you have Queen Elizabeth II and Empire, you have Mahatma Gandhi, the Kohinoor Diamond, that's an interesting story, and the curse of the Kohinoor Diamond, the Queen and Queens and the Kohinoor Diamond, and Queen Victoria in particular, and the patient assassin, Muhammad al-Jinnah, the last viceroy of India, who was Mountbatten, Lord Mountbatten. And then you have the partition of India into India and Pakistan, with the Muslims ending up in Pakistan because the Muslims weren't guaranteed non-minority or minority rights in India. So they end up in Pakistan, and the Indians end up with India, the Sikhs rather, or the Hindus end up in India. So the Brits recognised that if they were to pull out, there'd be wholesale war unless something was done, as they saw it, in relation to the inter-religious warfare that was inevitable, so between the Muslims and the Hindus. So the Brits, in a 10-week period, got a civil servant from the UK, from London, who had no association with, no knowledge of India, who knew nothing about India and was never there. In fact, the civil servant, the further he had ever travelled east was to Paris. He was brought, and he actually drew the line which created the partition between India and Pakistan. So now you have a Muslim state in Pakistan, and you have a predominantly Hindu religion in India. So that's how that came about. But the Empire, the podcast itself, then goes on to deal with the empire implodes. It goes on to do with, explains about Rishi Sunak's ancestry. Rishi Sunak's family, his ancestry actually comes from Uganda. So there was Indians in Uganda, and that was part of a colonial state, as it were, a colonial settlement by the Brits. They actually took it off the Germans after the Second World War or First World War. But Idi Amin threw out the Brits, and essentially the Britain then had to deal with the passport-holding UK people, Indians. And that's how Rishi Sunak's father and his family ended up in Britain. And he then obviously was born in Britain and became Prime Minister. But they can be thankful to Idi Amin, paradoxically, for that, because he threw them out of India and he only gave them, or out of Uganda, and gave non-nationalists, non-Africans, non-indigenous Africans a certain period of time, a very short period of time, just to go, to get out. So they did, and the East African Indians left Uganda. They were also in Kenya and Tanzania, but the East Indian Ugandans ended up in Britain, and they didn't know where else to go. And the Brits took them in and obviously had to stand over the passports, etc., etc., and give them recognition, give them council houses, National Health Service, and so on. And that's how Rishi Sunak, his family, came to Britain, and how, as I say, he was born in Britain, but obviously he comes from Indian ancestry, but not just Indian ancestry, from East African Indian ancestry. The podcast then goes on to other empires, for example, the Ottoman Empire, and that's one I'm very, very interested in, because I was in Istanbul there last year or the year before on my holidays, and that's whole Ottoman Empire story, the story of Constantinople, Istanbul, Byzantine, or Byzantium, very, very interesting. Byzantium and the rise of the Turks and the first of the Ottomans, the fall of Constantinople, Suleiman the Magnificent. I was actually in the alleged burial chamber, or where Suleiman the Magnificent is actually buried. So whether he's there or not, I don't know. I don't think he is. Then you go on to other other empires around the world, and Gallipoli, the American genocide, road to deportation, the Armenian genocide, or the Armenian genocide rather, carving up the Middle East, Lawrence of Arabia. So it's a fascinating podcast. It's called Empire. It's actually a Goalhanger production, and Goalhanger is actually Gary Lineker's company. I think it's a podcast creation company of Gary Lineker, the BBC guy, former international striker, obviously, for England. Great podcast. Would strongly recommend it. Empire, it's called. You'll get it on Spotify or iTunes or wherever. I wrote a blog post there yesterday about going to Nace Hospital last week. I had to go to Nace Hospital last week. I got a call early in the week from a local woman whose husband is in Nace Hospital. And it turns out that he is very ill. In fact, she wanted me to go to Nace to do a will for her husband. So I normally wouldn't leave the office if I could help it, but obviously there's a lot of time taken up going out of the office and so on and so forth. And anyway, on this particular occasion, because he's a neighbour of mine, because he's a fellow Broadford person, I said I would go. I did go. So I arranged then to go over last Thursday, and I had a good idea of the instructions from the gentleman in question. And went over to Nace and had the will pre-prepared, and all I really had to do was, one, ensure that I was satisfied that he knew what he was doing, because he's in a medical facility, he's in a hospital, and he has been ill, he's very ill, he's terminally ill, in fact, and the hospital can't do anything more for him. He is probably going to be let home to die at home, quite frankly, in peace. And that's what his wife wants, and she's looking to get him home because the hospital can't do any more for him. But my job going over was to do two things, essentially. One was to ascertain that he knew what he was doing. In other words, whatever his wishes in the will were, that he actually knew what he was doing, what it meant to make a will, and so on. The second thing was to witness the will. I could witness it, but I'd need another witness. Now, I had a difficulty in the past down in the Midlands somewhere, I think in a nursing home, not sure, maybe hospital, maybe at Lone or Mullingar or someplace. I had difficulty getting anybody to actually witness the will on that occasion. That was a good few years ago. So this was my second time, and I anticipated that I might have some reluctance to get a person who would witness the will along with myself. But nevertheless, I thought we'd get somebody. So I didn't bring anybody from the office here, and I could have brought somebody from the office, yes. But I didn't think it was necessary, because all the person witnessing the will would have to do is literally witness the will. In other words, witness the gentleman the testator making his signature. That's all that was being asked. So anyway, I went over and had a good old chat with him. I was there for 5, 10, 15 minutes, and his wife said, I'll go and get somebody to witness with you. And I said, that's great, thank you very much. And she went off, and she was gone for a good while. And she came back, and she could get nobody. Nurses didn't want to know, other staff there, doctors and so on, didn't want to know. They did not want to witness the will. And some of them were saying, well, he's not my patient, and others saying, I don't want to get involved and so on. And quite frankly, I can't understand this myself, because you're not being asked as a medical person to give any opinion. You're not being asked to do any legal work. You're not being asked to do anything other than witness the will. And I was surprised. Eventually we got a young doctor, I'd say relatively newly qualified doctor, and he had a northern accent, north of Ireland accent actually, so perhaps he was naive, I don't know, but he was generous and he was kind enough to just witness the will. So we witnessed it, myself and himself. I got details from him. I did an attendance afterwards. I had talked to the testator. I was absolutely satisfied. He knew what he was doing. And I can't see any difficulty with the will. So I can't see any difficulty, but I did a blog post about it then, and I tweeted about it, and I had medical persons, nurses and so on, people working in the medical area, saying, oh yeah, that's right, I can understand that. They didn't want to do any legal work, and we've been advised, etc. Nobody is asking the person who is witnessing a will to do any legal work. Nobody is asking them to give any opinion about the testamentary capacity of the testator. Nobody is asking them to give any indemnity in respect of anything. All that's being asked is that you put your signature to the will to confirm that you have witnessed this gentleman making his signature. It's as simple as that. The question of testamentary capacity then might arise later on, but the bottom line is, if I have a nurse or a doctor or a cleaning person or some other support staff from the hospital who has signed the will, then I'm not going to be asking that person who has simply obliged me with witnessing the will, who cannot give any opinion about the testamentary capacity of the person, I'm not going to be asking them to do an affidavit about their view or their opinion as to the testamentary capacity of the testator. Because I know I've only got the person to witness the will, but I'll do the affidavit of testamentary capacity. I've spent 20 minutes with the man, and I'm putting my name to the will, and I'm happy he knows what he's doing. And if he didn't know what he was doing, I wouldn't be witnessing the will. I wouldn't be producing the will at all. I'd be taking it away and saying, look, Johnny or Jack or Mary, we can't do this. So I'm surprised, as I say, that the person in the medical game, in the caring profession and so on, wouldn't. Basically, this man is dying. I'm surprised that somebody would not say, you know, I'm going to witness this will and there's no big deal. I'd say there may well be some, you know, misunderstanding about the role of a person witnessing a will, but a person witnessing a will is simply a person witnessing a will. In other words, they witness the will and that's it. And they're witnessing and saying that that person made that signature and I was in the room and I saw it. That's all. Anyway, it's a bit frustrating. I'll be careful, much more careful in future going. I'll probably have to bring someone from the office to be sure that there's no messing around. But it's a bit of a shame, quite frankly. You know, I'm a bit frustrated with that. Anyway, it's 25 to 7 now, and I have a meeting actually at 7 o'clock. I have a signing at 7 a.m. So if you want an early consultation or an early signing or an early... you're buying a property and you want to sign contracts, etc., at a time that suits you, well then, signing early suits many people. Signing late doesn't suit me. I'm not a late bird, but I am an early riser. I'm an early bird, and therefore, if you want a consultation at 6 o'clock in the morning, 7 o'clock in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, no problem. Anyway, 25 to 7 now, and I have a lad coming in at 7 o'clock to sign a lease. draw up a disclaimer, draft a disclaimer there at the moment, and it's not too often you'd be drafting disclaimers. A disclaimer is a legal document where a person who is the beneficiary in an estate, the beneficiary of a will, essentially says, I'm not taking the benefit, I'm disclaiming it. So that's what I'm drafting at the moment. I've done a few, one or two over the last 10 years or so, but only one or two. So it's not too often that people are actually disclaiming their benefit in an estate. Normally they're actually fighting over what's in the estate, or whinging and complaining and fighting over what they did or didn't get. So it's unusual to be drafting a disclaimer, and for that reason I've got the old probate manual here just to have a look at a precedent or two. That's the story. Anyway, it is 7:40 now, so I'm going to have my first coffee, and I'm not going to go to Nomad today. I'm just going to make my own here. It's all right, it's not bad if you make it strong enough. I like strong coffee. So I've had my meeting there at 7 o'clock this morning, my signing. Now I have a Zoom meeting at 9 o'clock. Zoom at 9, I think it's an employment situation. And then I have a signing at 12 o'clock, that's a chap who bought property. I acted for him, he's signing for deed of transfer and just a deed of transfer actually. And then I have a meeting at 2 o'clock. That's a consultation in person, and that's a family law situation. And then I have a meeting at 3 o'clock, and that's an unfair dismissal employment law query, so that's in person as well. So that's what I have today. It's 8:25 now, and I'm just waiting to let the postman in. He normally comes, well, Brendan normally comes around now, but Brendan is always the most consistent and earliest of the post persons, so I'm keeping an eye out for him. I have to buzz him in there to the building. It's a good site, a good bit of land across the road for sale there. Prime land, 16 acres, right in the middle of the village on the main street. That will probably fetch good old money. I'm not sure what the zoning scenario is at the moment on it. I think it had zoning for perhaps residential. I'm not sure what the status of it is now. It's slap bang in the middle of the village. And clearly it's a site of great value actually. And it'll be good to see it developed and see residential and or commercial there. I'd say that's what will probably go in there, a mixed development of residential and commercial, particularly given the main street frontage and so on it. So it'll be very interesting to see who buys that, if it sells, and what way it's developed and what happens. Obviously it'll be good for my business here as well in the years to come, especially with, if there's a lot of residential in it and that, houses and so on. Obviously people need a solicitor to act for them, so but that'll be an interesting development. And as I say, it's a site that's there since I was a child actually, so it's sort of an agricultural land holding site on the main street in a pretty busy little town now, so it's an unusual scenario, you know. Thank you. lunchtime here now, 1:30 or thereabouts. I'm just listening to the news at 1:00, and there's a story there about a lady who was brought to Ireland from India to work as a party chef or chef de partie, and she has just been awarded €150,000 against her employer, who was seen to have allowed her to be discriminated against, sexually harassed, exploited, etc. She was paid less. She was paid €4 something per hour. She's working something like 50 hours a week. She was doing work that she wasn't supposed to be doing. In other words, basic manual labour stuff, lifting and pulling and dragging, when she was supposed to be brought over as a chef. And she, as I say, was discriminated against, sexually harassed. She's been awarded €150,000 by WRC against her employer. I think her employer was in Skerries, and I think it was something like Bombay something or other was the name of the employer, but not 100% on that now. I just heard it on the news there, and I'm just relaying what I heard on the news. But she was here on a general work permit, and the problem with that for any employee is that they're tied to the one employer for 5 years. If it's a general permit, if it's a critical skills permit, they're not tied for 5 years. They have to stay, I think it's for 2 years in the job. But shocking exploitation in this day and age to be going on in Dublin, in Ireland, in 2024. But €150,000 will definitely soften the cough of the employer. Whether she gets it or not now remains to be seen. It's another thing, but it's shocking that that sort of carry on still goes on with some employers exploiting people mercilessly, unfortunately. Somebody doing a bit of work there next door now, a bit of banging. So I'm going to wrap up this, and I'll start the video editing process for this particular video, and I'll finish it off maybe tomorrow then. I might shoot another little bit, but I want to see how much footage I have. So it's lunchtime now, and I'll just spend 10 or 15 minutes doing this. And that's what I do often when I'm doing a video, a day in the life type video or a vlog type video. I actually get a good bit of footage early in the day, and then by lunchtime I actually begin to bring it together into the video and begin to edit it. And then later on I might perhaps do another couple of pieces, but that'll probably be that. And then tomorrow or the next day I can finish it off and publish it on my YouTube channel whenever I want to. So that's the plan now.